2020 election was going to be a stress test for American democracy under the best of circumstances. Now, add a pandemic, and the election will easily be one of the most chaotic, hotly contested elections in American history. Professor and legal scholar Lawrence Douglas's new book, Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020, outlines how Trump is likely to threaten the most important principle of democratic governance, the peaceful succession of power. Not by refusing to leave office, but by undermining our faith in the tenets of a free and fair election. Professor Douglas says if Trump rejects his defeat in November, our constitutional and legal systems are exceptionally ill-prepared to manage and resolve that challenge. Lawrence Douglas is the James Grossfeld Professor of Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought at Amherst College, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. What got you thinking about this, and is it something you've been thinking about since 2016?
Yeah, actually, I really started thinking about it in 2016. Shortly after Trump was inaugurated, I started writing pretty regularly for The Guardian, the British paper, writing commentary for them. And one of the first pieces I wrote was about Trump's insistence that he would have won the popular vote in 2016 if 3 to 5 million illegal voters hadn't cost him the popular vote victory. And at the time, I really started thinking, like, oh, my God, imagine the kind of damage if an incumbent refuses to acknowledge defeat. I mean, here it was the case of a candidate who had won, who was denying the terms of his victory. Imagine if an incumbent were to deny the terms of his defeat. That struck me as a potentially very, very dangerous situation.
Like many things when we discuss Donald Trump and his administration, how much gets down to his actions, meaning that it's not logical really to even question if you've won, but he has, and it brings us to the age-old question, you know, is he crazy or crazy like a fox?
Well, I certainly don't think he's crazy, and I do think that he kind of has a genius for creating chaos. And, you know, one of the things that people have been saying about him since even before the election when he was a candidate, they were saying, like, I mean, this is a guy who's not simply ignoring the kind of guardrails of American constitutional democracy. He's kind of smashing through them. And everyone predicted, well, you can't do that. You can't just kind of ignore the norms that control American democracy and not pay a political price. And I think one of the most astonishing things about this president is the way in which he's been able to kind of smash through these guardrails and not pay a price. And to the extent that he hasn't paid a price, and in fact has been pretty consistently rewarded for his behavior, you know, there's nothing irrational about repeating a behavior that gets you rewards. In fact, you could almost say that's the definition of rational behavior.
Right.
You repeat the things that get you rewards. And the rewards that he's reaped have been, you know, pretty substantial. He's the president of the United States, and he has a Republican Party which is willing to stand by him no matter what he does. And that's again, is the kind of scary thing. I mean, if it were just him acting alone, you would say, well, again, he's going to pay a price for this. But the fact that he has all these enablers, both in the media and in his party, kind of make his lack of any kind of constraints a very, you know, dangerous situation.
You set out the book in the first part, which with a chapter titled November 3rd, 2020, The Greatest Fraud in History. So set up the scenario of what you think very well could happen.
Well, they're kind of really sort of, you know, I sort of run through kind of three different catastrophe scenarios in the course of the book. And, you know, one of the scenarios could involve something like, you know, imagine a power failure in something like Detroit on November 3rd. And as a result of that, the votes aren't counted in Wayne County. And we know from the last election that 70,000 votes in total in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania cost Hillary Clinton the election. So it was really kind of these razor margin, these razor thin margins in three swing states. Those states are likely to be in play in 2020. They're likely to be the ones that will dictate the outcome of the election. And if you had something like a power failure in, you know, Wayne County, and again, this power failure could be the result of, you know, we can imagine things. Who knows? It could be a climate change-related natural disaster. It could be the result of foreign interference with our electrical grid. But as a result of that, there are a substantial number of votes that that aren't either counted or actually balloted on Election Day. You could imagine something like having a revote counted. And then as soon as something turns anomalous, and Joe, I think this is the issue, as soon as something turns anomalous, if you have a president who has been consistently attacking the integrity of the electoral process, then suddenly you had tens of millions of people thinking that, well, something that was an unfortunate event is really the result of some kind of conspiracy to oust this president. And so it just creates opportunities for him to challenge the result if the result has him losing.
So if that happens and he challenges it, it'll be, I mean, we've seen this consistently, that there will be some, there could be several. It doesn't have to be any one of these, right? It could be, a lot of these could be put into play and really see what sticks, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, again, we've already seen them. It's not as if, I mean, one thing about Trump is he's pretty good at telegraphing his intentions. It's not as if it's really kind of a secret what he's going to do. So we know right now, like with the COVID outbreak, we saw, for example, in April when Wisconsin had its primary and also its kind of its state election, for example, the state Supreme Court, we saw that the voting there was chaotic. We saw that there are a lot of mail-in ballots. And we've seen that that's probably something that is going to repeat in the fall. We're likely to have, you know, God forbid, but a kind of a fresh outbreak of COVID. That could create all sorts of problems come Election Day. We're no doubt going to see a much greater reliance on mail-in ballots, and the heavy reliance on mail-in ballots is going to create opportunities for him to challenge them as fraudulent. He's already started doing that. He's already started to consistently attack the integrity of all mail-in ballots. And so this is, again, kind of hand-delivering him an opportunity to challenge the result if, again, that result doesn't have him prevailing in the election.
This probably should have been the first question I asked you, but in this, and I'm interested in why, but in this, you do make, you're making the distinction that Trump loses, not that he loses, and so he loses, and then is challenging the results, which is different than he refuses to leave office.
Yes, exactly. Right. So I'm not creating some kind of, you know, thriller scenario in which we have a rogue president who's barricaded himself in the Oval Office, surrounded by a phalanx of, you know, rogue Secret Service agents. I mean, that's not exactly my model here. My model is really to ask, you know, what happens if there's a very, you know, a closely contested election that turns on these kind of, you know, razor-thin margins like we saw in 2020, and we saw even much more dramatically in the year 2000. I mean, when we saw in 2016 and much more dramatically in 2000. And then you suddenly have a Donald Trump, we're slotting him in the place of like an Al Gore in 2000. I think that's just an incredibly dangerous situation. If you had had Trump in Gore's position in 2000, you would have had, you know, you probably would have had a complete paralysis of the electoral system.
How much of this depends on the margin of victory? Let's say it's by Joe Biden. So if we're talking that the president gets 30% of the vote versus, you know, a razor thin 47%. Does that make a huge difference?
I think it does. I think the only way really to avoid, I would say this, the way to avoid a kind of a real electoral crisis in the fall, I guess there are two ways. One is Trump simply is reelected, which is not a completely unlikely scenario, obviously. I think it would be terrible for the nation, really kind of perhaps catastrophic for the nation, but it's certainly a, you know, not unlikely outcome. And the other one is if Biden wins decisively. If Biden wins very decisively, then I really do think that Trump's wiggle room is limited, and I think that even his supporters in the Republican Party will recognize that he has to go. I think the danger arises if it is, again, kind of like a very, very tight result that turns on the result in a handful of swing states like we saw in 2016. And unfortunately, I think that's really what we're going to see. It's really hard to imagine Trump or Biden winning decisively. We're much more likely to see a very, very, I mean, we have a very divided country. We have things very evenly split. And even if it were the case that Biden won the popular vote by a margin even greater than Hillary Clinton's 3 million in 2016, that, again, is sort of irrelevant for the purposes of tallying electoral college votes. So I do think that it's going to, you know, it's probably going to turn on Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania once again.
You write early in the book, candidate Trump refused, in the third and final debate with Hillary Clinton, candidate Trump refused to answer when moderator Chris Wallace asked him whether he would, quote, absolutely accept the result of an electoral loss. I'll look at it at the time, Trump responded. Reminded by Wallace that the peaceful transition of power is a critical feature of our constitutional order and essential to American political stability, Trump still refused to commit to accepting the results. I'll tell you at the time, he repeated. I'll keep you in suspense. The comment left Hillary Clinton visibly stunned, calling Trump's response horrifying. But he won. So,
well, Joe, this goes exactly back to what I was saying. In fact, it wasn't just Hillary Clinton who was stunned. You had all these, you had people within the Republican Party themselves at the time. I mean, this is when there was still greater opposition to Trump within the
right.
Republican Party. But, you know, you had people within the Republican Party saying, you know, this guy just put nails in his own coffin. I mean, you can't challenge peaceful succession and expect to get elected. And, you know, I remember people having these discussions. I remember I myself had these discussions thinking like, wow, imagine if there were a Trump-like candidate who came along who wasn't so clearly self-destructive as Trump, because obviously he just self-destructed in front of Chris Wallace in that final debate. And yet he didn't. No, he didn't pay the price at all. And again, this is a point that I mentioned a little earlier, which is very worrisome about the state of our democracy. It's that actions that should be punished are not. He consistently is rewarded for just kind of smashing through these guardrails of constitutional civility and the norms of democracy.
You make the point in the book to remind us of what happened in the 2018 midterms, that even in looking at Florida, he was still taking some of the results, questioning many of the results, and saying that that the Florida election should be called in favor of Rick Scott, that new ballots showed up out of nowhere and many ballots are missing or forged, an honest vote count is no longer possible, ballots massively infected must go with election night. So this is something, the recounts did not overturn DeSantis's and Scott's victories, but rather confirm them. But you write, the episode again revealed a Trump fully prepared to attack the integrity of the electoral process in order to get the results that he wants, which we see even when it doesn't come to elections, right? There is this bullying that takes place on Twitter. I'm just wondering if, I do understand your point of the Republicans behind him, but if they lose the House and the Senate, if the Republicans lose the House, you know, if that the House stays in Democratic hands, they lose the Senate. They have the last ditch effort to try to hold on to the power, right?
Well, actually, the point that you're making is a very important one, because a lot of these scenarios of a kind of meltdown in the wake of an election in November, I think they would change very dramatically if the Democrats capture the Senate and hold the House. If the Republicans are successful in holding on to the Senate, that's when we see these kind of nightmare scenarios.
Right.
Because really what could happen in a contested election, and this is something that you can go back to, and for your listeners who are American history buffs, they might remember the contested Hayes-Tilden election, or having read about and studied, not remembered, the Hayes-Tilden election of 1876. But that is something where if you have a really tightly contested result in a state, you could have something that when it comes to the Congresses, Congress ultimately is the body which is constitutionally responsible for tallying Electoral College votes. And they do this on January 6th. They'll do it on January 6th, 2021. And most Americans pay no attention to that day. It's largely a formulaic exercise. They get together, they open up the ballots, they count the Electoral College votes. We already know who the president is going to be. But again, in a really, really tight election, that tallying is no longer just a ceremonial task. It can be a real task of counting votes and determining who the next president is. And if you have a divided Congress, Senate controlled by Republicans, House controlled by Democrats, you could really have a very, very destructive situation in which, for example, Democrats recognize one set of electoral votes coming from, let's take one of our swing states, call it Wisconsin,
right,
and then the Republicans recognizing a different set of votes coming from Wisconsin. And it could all turn on something like the Republicans say, we're going to go with the vote on Election Day, which has Trump narrowly winning, and the Democrats saying, no, we're going to go with the vote that you've discounted all these absentee ballots that aren't counted until, you know, a full week after the election results. And those show Biden winning. And that suddenly is a really dangerous situation, because you then have kind of election meltdown in which the Constitution and federal law really doesn't provide any blueprint from exiting.
Well, and that is that's the point. I mean, that's what we found this out in 2000, and of course, we continually find out in this administration that many of the guardrails that we think are in place don't really work very well. But my question is, what if there is a Democratic victory, the other way around, that Trump wins? And then what can the Democrats say? Because there's still the question of, if we're voting by mail during a pandemic, what does that mean? How secure is that, given what the president has said about mail-in elections, as well as what he's said about the Postal Service itself? And also, what does it say about interference, Russian interference and other interference, which has basically been pushed to the side?
Absolutely. And the Russian interference, I mean, it can take, two forms. It can obviously take forms with, like, a direct meddling. It could take forms with, let's be honest. I mean, it is the case that mail-in ballots are vulnerable. You know, it's not the case that they're invulnerable, and that, you know, I mean, he's making these allegations of fraud, of course, preemptively, without any kind of proof of fraud. But, you know, bad things can happen when you're dealing with mail-in ballots. But the point of Russian interference, or, you know, you could even imagine Chinese interference as well, is that it also could just play, it could, you know, circulate in social media these allegations that the results cannot be trusted. And that's the really dangerous thing, of when the electorate no longer has faith in the integrity of the electoral system. And it becomes a really kind of dangerous situation, again, when you have, I mean, if you look at Pennsylvania, I mean, this is also kind of like an incredible sort of perfect storm brewing, that if you look at our swing states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, they all have the same profile, in which they have a Republican-controlled House, that is state House, and you have Democratic governors. And so, again, you could imagine that in all three states, if you have a lot of mail-in ballots and the mail-in ballots swing Democratic, whereas, let's say, the Election Day result swings Trump, you could have the Republicans saying, yeah, we're just going to ignore those mail-in ballots. We're going to and just go with the Election Day results, and have the Democratic governor saying, I refuse to do that. I'm going to recognize the mail-in ballot results. And then you have these competing electoral results being mailed on to Congress, and then there, Congress in early 2021, January 6th, when it comes to tallying, if you have a divided Congress, you have the same paralysis that manifests itself on the state level, on the federal level now. And now we're in a big world of hurt.
You write about this, we touched on it, but you write, we have made the disturbing but confident prediction that anything short of a clear and emphatic defeat in 2020 will embolden Trump to either reject an electoral loss outright or, in the case of an uncertain result, refuse to accept any outcome other than victory. Could he succeed in such an unprecedented act of electoral nullification? How well equipped is our system to repulse such an attack? My read of your book is it's not great.
Yeah, no, we're not well equipped at all. No, it is. Again, I don't mean to be like, to, you know, scare people or anything like that. I mean, hopefully the idea is to, you know, kind of provide a warning. But it is the case that, you know, if you kind of think about, oh, well, we must have these federal laws or we must have these constitutional procedures that are in place to deal with a problem like that. And what you see is that both the Constitution and the federal law, it's not so much that they secure the peaceful succession of power. They kind of just presuppose it's going to happen. And so if for some reason it doesn't, they don't provide a whole lot of guidance for how to walk back once you find yourself in some kind of electoral crisis. And it's, you know, I think it's telling, Joe, that you brought up the case in 2000. Because in that case, a lot of people, I think, mistakenly believe that, oh, well, they're the Supreme Court, things were getting chaotic, the Supreme Court stepped in, for better or worse, in a pretty partisan decision, they finally at least brought closure to the election. But I think that's actually misleading. I don't think it was the Supreme Court that brought closure. It was really Al Gore who brought closure,
right?
Because he accepted the result of the Supreme Court, and he didn't have to do that. And if you, and this is again where I think it becomes so dangerous, if you imagine an incumbent like Trump in the position of a candidate like Gore. Because there's no way that Trump would have accepted the Supreme Court's decision in 2000. He just wouldn't have. And then, you know, if you have, like, the incumbent president refusing to abide by a Supreme Court decision, you know, it's a little bit like back in Andrew Jackson's day when he allegedly said, you know, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Marshall, made his decision, now let him go and enforce it.
So, but if it goes to the Supreme Court, then what is the Supreme Court's final say? I mean, what ultimate decision do they have then?
It really, again, if experts disagree about this, I mean, there are experts who say that, well, the Supreme Court has these final matters in resolving these things. And then in particular, if the controversy gets to the Congress, so in that scenario where I was describing in which Congress gets maybe competing electoral count votes from, let's say, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, then a lot of experts say once an election reaches Congress on January 6th, the Supreme Court has no role whatsoever. They just don't have jurisdiction over the matter. And if that's the case, and you find Congress in a deadlock, unable to resolve things, and the Supreme Court having no authority to step in to resolve the case at that point, then you could very well imagine us approaching January 20th without having anyone elected president. And that's not a good scenario. Again, this kind of happened all the way back in the Hayes-Tilden election, 1876,
right,
where you came close to that election, was finally resolved only 2 days before Inauguration Day.
Well, the book is fascinating and frightening and really important. It is Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown of 2020. Lawrence Douglas, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
It was an absolute pleasure being on your program. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Will He Go? It's published by 12. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.